If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment cause chaos. Use ShipStation instead. From running a business out of your garage to multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating tasks. Plus, you'll get the best shipping rates from global carriers. Calm the chaos with the shipping software that delivers. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small cap. So welcome, Paul.
Hello, Paul. Hello, everyone.
Now, before we start cracking into specific stocks, we've got a bit of a system technical issue at the moment with our software Streamline. Paul's online fine. I'm online fine. So everybody's connected, but we are getting a few sort of gaps in the video. So hopefully everybody will be able to hear what we say and it will just be a bit of a nuisance. But if it gets too bad, then we'll have to abandon it. It's all that sort of like best laid plans, a bit like the UK spending review yesterday. But let's move on to Rachel Reeves yesterday. Have you got any sort of top level thoughts, Paul, or sort of comments who might be the winners and losers from yesterday's sort of like big event down at Westminster?
Not really. I mean, it was mainly a party political broadcast, wasn't it, really? Just re-announcing things that they'd already announced. So I thought the whole thing was a damp squib. There was a good article by Liam Halligan in the on his Substack and saying they're now really close to the edge in terms of spending and borrowing and bond markets and all the rest of it. So, but the bond markets seem to have taken it in their stride so far. And obviously housing is a big beneficiary, isn't it? But we already knew that. So I don't think overall there's really much of any significance for investors.
Yeah, well, let's dig into that sort of housing to apologise for the pun. Let's go to Vistry, which is obviously potentially a big beneficiary of the huge, you know, sort of build plans on social housing, on affordable homes, etc., because it's got about 2/3 of its revenue, I think, coming from social housing. Its shares were up 6 or 7%. They now trade at just over net tangible assets. I don't suppose you've got any thoughts on this one, because it has been through the mill over the last 12 months. It was a darling and then had a few contract problems in its South division.
Yeah, I mean, I've followed Vistry for a while now, and in a slightly odd move looking back, I actually put it on my top 20 list of share ideas for this year. But I think that was when it was at or near the lows, and it has bounced a bit. I think it's probably up with events now. I mean, they're not the only house builder doing build to rent for large organizations. There are the other house builders are starting to do this as well. So personally, I wouldn't want to pay much more than net tangible asset value for Vistry anyway. So what are they now? About £7, are they a share?
Yeah, they're 6.80. They looks as though they trade on roughly around less than 12 times PE, 4.3% dividend yield. Balance sheet looks relatively decent. It looks okay.
Yeah, the balance sheet's good. Although you did flag up previously, I think, that they've got quite large JV type vehicles in there. But back in January, when it was around £5.50, and I think at that level it was a glaring bargain. Less of a bargain now, I would personally say. But I'm still moderately positive on Vistry.
Yeah. What about its sort of competitor, Bellway, which does more sort of private homes? It came out with a pretty much a reassuring trading update this week, talked about having good visibility and lower mortgage rates, but was being impacted, like they all are, a bit on costs, which I think they're sort of cost inflation of the low single digits. Trades, it did at that before the uplift in the share price, did trade at below net tangible assets. But what's your sort of views on this one?
We thought it was a good update. That was 10th of June. So that was, what was that, Tuesday, wasn't it, this week? The order book, they said, was robust and up 7%. Completions for the full year, I think it's, is it a calendar year? Might not be, actually. I can't remember exactly what the period is. Yeah. It might be a calendar year. But the number of completions are expected to be between 8,600 and 8,700. Operating margin's pretty good, 11%. And the balance sheet at Bellway is really, really strong. Nothing complicated in there. Just, as you say, about $3.5 billion net tangible asset value. So, yeah, we like this one as well, I think. But it's had a good pop recently, I think, hasn't it? So,
yeah.
Amber Green on my race, so four out of five on my sort of rating system for Bellway. I think it's good.
Yeah. What about, let's move to the bit earlier in the sort of the cycle on this one, the suppliers into it. What about the brickmaker? What about Ipstock? Surprisingly came out with a bit of a profit warning. It was supposed to be hitting sort of like, 13% increase in EBITDA this year. And then it's talked about being flat now year on year because of cost. So something's going slightly wrong there with Ipstock.
Yeah, it seems to be, doesn't it? We were taken by surprise by this. This was yesterday, a profit warning. My colleague John looked at it prior to the market open, and basically he said, I think this is about a 15% miss. And that is at the using EBITDA. And of course, as you flow down the P&L, the misses tend to get bigger as you go down to PBT. So it might be about a 20% PBT miss at Ipstock, which we were very surprised at, because it said the activity levels are well above last year, H1 sales materially above last year, but higher fixed costs. Well, surely the nature of fixed costs is they're fixed and you can budget for them as you know what they are. So I didn't quite understand this. It does look like something company specific. Maybe they've got their budgeting wrong at Ipstock. And I think it might have also mentioned sales mix. So, and that I think they're struggling to pass through price rises in full to their customers. So that I was a little bit taken aback by that. So what's your view, Paul? Because you're in Michelmersh, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I mean, the way I read it was that the pricing is obviously quite a tough area. That was like, to push prices up. They've got more exposure, or they're getting more volume through on new build, which is tougher pricing than sort of like RMI, which is the repair maintenance sector, where they've got better margins. So they are getting a slight negative mix impact. In terms of their fixed cost, the way I read it actually was they're bringing on this mothballed capacity again, stuff that they haven't actually, and therefore you've got startup costs. So effectively you've got, if you've mothballed a site, or you haven't really sort of started, doing production, or you stopped production for a bit, then you've got to obviously one-off sort of like fixed costs to get new people in, to get, all that sort of startup stuff. So I think that's what it is. I think it's starting the wheels turning again on their facilities that they went mothballed on.
Yeah, but surely that should have been budgeted for, really.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it probably should have been budgeted for, but that's how I read it, rather than sort of like, just explaining the sort of the fixed cost. And I think also they say they got the mix wrong. They must have done that.
I mean, we have been saying three or four times prior to this week on Ipstock that there was too much recovery priced into the shares. So we felt, we didn't want to pay up front. It was on a PE of 20 prior to the profit warning. And we thought, we don't want to be paying up a forecast PE, that is. We think that's too much, because a brick builder, a brick maker would normally be on a PE of about 10.
Yeah.
So why would I want to pay 20 times in anticipation? You're basically then anticipating earnings doubling, which they might do, but I don't want to pay up front for it when I can buy Brickability, a distributor of bricks rather than a maker of them, on a PE of about 7 or 8. I think that's a much more attractive investment proposition. But obviously I hold personally, so I'm talking my own book there.
Yeah. I think it's just a matter of time. If you're an investor, and then Ben Sharman's asking about the sector and the brick suppliers, particularly he says he holds Brickability, Michelmers, Crest Nicholson, Taylor Wimpey, and Springfield. So he's got an army of brickmakers, or should we say house builders. I would say we just got to be patient and wait. I mean, if you've held for a long time, I would not bail out at the moment, because I think actually the good times are going to come forward. And even if you're more exposed to the private sector rather than the affordable, you know, social care, if effectively volumes are sucked into that social or affordable care market, then they'll lift all boats. And so it'll improve the pricing in your private sales as well, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think it just depends on valuation, though, doesn't it? I think, I like all those names that Ben just mentioned, but Ibstock, for me, it's the valuation that I've been challenging all this year, really. And after a profit warning, more so, you know.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got Rising Bull 1985. He's asking about Volex, which is, he says, is up 17% in the month. I'm sure everything else is as well. can it keep going higher, basically? But I guess it all comes down to what Trump is going to be throwing around, because he has this morning or last night warned that he's going to basically just mandate sort of tariffs on some of these partners, albeit he did come back licking his wounds from the negotiations trade with China, I think, the last couple of days.
Yeah, I think it's the law of diminishing returns with Trump, isn't it? I think personally, I'm barely even following the news on his latest pronouncements, because so much of it is he hasn't actually got the legal power to do. And he seems to backtrack. We've got an American friend staying with us actually at the moment who's from LA. And apparently they're calling him Taco, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Trump always chickens out. Yeah, it chickens out. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I don't, and I've been amazed actually of how few companies have said that, UK companies anyway, have said that they expect any serious impact from tariffs. So it's not really an issue that I'm particularly worried about anymore. With Volex, we've not had any recent news on it. We did flag the value very much so at the low. On the 7th of April, it put out a trading update, and it was only £2.16. And we said this is really good value at that level. And, I mean, it's up about, mind you, you could have said anything was good value on the 7th of April and you'd look a genius now. But it did actually specifically say, Volex did on the 7th of April, that it expects to pass through tariffs. And that it's embedded in the supply chains that it supplies, often for a sort of fixed term for at fixed prices. And of course, the customer, I presume, then would be liable for the import duties. It's not the it's not the exporter who pays the import duties. It's the end customer in America, isn't it? So, look, it's had a really good run. Volex has. I think there's no harm in taking a bit of profit on things that are up 40-50%, is there?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would agree. It was quite interesting, actually. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning saying how much America had collected in tariffs in May, and it was $22 billion. Yeah. So I bet Rachel Reeves could do with that in a back pocket. But unfortunately, that's what you get when you've got to be the biggest economy in the world and the strongest, no doubt about
it. Yes, yes. How much was that up year on year? Because that's the...
I think it was up about four or five times. I think the average about a year ago were about $4 or $5 billion, something like that. But significant.
And of course, with the numbers in America, we always have to divide them by about seven to... Yeah. Get to what it would be for a UK government, don't we? So it's not such a big number. It's only 3 or 4 billion in a month. It's still a useful amount of tax, though, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And just more broadly, you mentioned about sort of like this recent bounce. How are you positioning your portfolio in terms of, are you looking now to take a few profits off the table given the bounce, or do you think it's going to continue? Because there is an argument to say that part of the rally, obviously we had the Liberation Day U-turn, but other ones was the US earnings came in much stronger in Q1 than people are expecting going into the the corporate earnings season. I think analysts had expected the S&P 500 to be up about 7%. It came in over 13%, almost double what expectations were. So it was much stronger, which helped also push stock markets up. But Q2, you know, is not going to benefit from the one-off imports, you know, all that big boost of sort of like, you know, products being brought into the States. And likewise with the UK, if you've got a UK supplier stuff in the channel ahead of those particular tariffs. So we're going to have a bit of a reset on profits in the second half. How are you sort of positioning your own portfolio going into perhaps a potentially softer period for you know, certainly on quarterly earnings when we come to start reporting in July, which is not far off actually.
No, that's right. I mean, I'm not really taking an overall macro view, particularly. I'm looking at all the individual stocks I hold, and quite a few of them have been laggards that haven't really rallied at all in the last few months, in particular Spectra Systems and Beeks Financial Cloud. Just seem dead. Nobody's interested in them, which I think both are really good companies. Now, there's a risk there might be a profit warning. You have that risk is omnipresent with smaller caps, especially, isn't it? That's why you have a basket of 30 or 40 of them, and you'll get hit with the odd profit warning, as you and I did with Cordell.
Yes.
This week, incidentally. But are we going to come on to that one, I expect? But,
yeah, no, we will do. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so no, I think I'm looking at all my individual stocks. If something's rallied 30, 40, 50% and it looks, you know, reasonably priced, I'll sell them. I've only sold a couple. I can't remember what they are. I should have written them down, shouldn't I? But nothing, none of my big positions. Because I'm trying to free up money to buy other things. Because, I mean, I'm just finding opportunities literally every day, things I want to top up. Particularly as well, shares that are fundamentally really good, but have had a mild profit warning. Say, for example, a Hollywood Bowl. You see, I thought that was a really quite trivial profit warning. But it's knocked a good lump out of the share price when everything else has been rallying strongly. So I think there are opportunities in that that type of share as well. How about you, Paul? You don't really trade much, do you, sir?
No, I don't. But I've actually been taking or thinking about taking some profit off the top. I've taken profits already on Traxys actually just this week because of
Traxys.
On Traxys, yeah.
I have as well. And Lynn's ISA, who I look after.
Yeah.
I sold about 30% of them.
Mm. Yeah, I mean the only reason why I thought they've done really well, and I'm positive about the company. There's no doubt about it, but I've been a bit bruised and battered with Argentex, and I thought right, okay, I'll just take some money off the table since it's run so hard. And coming on to the let's go to Cordal because you mentioned it, etc. It operates in the same sort of area. It does LiDAR technology with an AI overlap overlay to basically look at to put a digital twin of the track and for maintenance and vegetation and bridges and stuff like that for improving the state of repair of particular tracks. And it's won some contracts in the States, but came out with a bit of a softer trading update saying it'd seen some delays in order flow because of the uncertainty out in the States. What's your sort of your latest on this one? I don't own Cordal. I own Traxys, but what was your view?
I was really annoyed by this actually, because I bought just after a positive announcement on the 2nd of June, so very recent, on a new American Class 1 contract that was announced. The third major US customer, all looked very good. And Cavendish said this underpins unchanged forecasts. So I thought, well, that all sounds good. Then, literally a week later, on the 9th of June this week, it puts out a profit warning. I mean, this is really, really poor, I think. Not a disastrous profit warning, it has to be said. And the other bizarre thing about it is Cavendish actually left the profit figure unchanged by somehow finding a huge amount of operational expenses savings. Now, this is for the June 2025 year end. So how on earth have they found all these cost savings in the last 3 weeks of the year? So to me, none of it. I mean, I'd quite like to talk to the company, actually, or the broker, because it didn't stack up. But then I thought, well, actually, it's not a disastrous profit warning. It was basically just some contract have slipped past the June year end. So I think they really need to strengthen their their forecasting and their, you know, be more prudent with what they put into the. I'd rather companies just put modest forecasts out and then beat them, you know, not putting ambitious targets. But fundamentally, I think that, you know, I always decide, is the business model fundamentally broken? If it is, I'm out. You know, I'll just cut the position and move on. Because as much as anything, you know, it's the stress of it all, having to, you don't want to be seeing red ink on your screen. You know, if the thesis has gone wrong, just chuck them out. That's my view these days. But I actually think the business model's still pretty good. And it did recover on the day. It was down 20-odd%, 24%, and it recovered half of that on the day, which is, again, is a good sign that the market thinks this is a bump in the road rather than a, let's do a rail analogy. It's a small overhanging branch, not a complete tree blocking the line.
Yeah. No, I love the technology. I think it's really good. It's state of the art. And it just shows if people like Amtrak will sign contracts with it, then it's got to be first, best in class as much as anything. I would say part of the reason why you've had a reduction in sales, but not a reduction in profit, could be that they sell the equipment into the customer at zero cost and then charge them for the service for the AI maintenance and what they use. So that would chime with how Cavendish have built it, because they won't make any difference to the profit line if they sell the product in. It's when they start using it on the track and it's a consumption model. I think that's where the higher margin is, the consumption side with all the AI overlay.
Yeah, no, that sounds plausible. Are any of the readers complaining about the picture cutting out? Or are you getting any complaints? Or
that's a good question. Yeah, if anybody's getting getting all this cut out, then please let me know, because myself and Paul are definitely getting it, aren't we? Okay, we've got one quick question from SE81. He's asking me about our Gentex final thoughts, and I'd just like to say to everybody, thank you for everybody who voted against the offer from IFX Payments at 2.49%. We nearly did it. We got 18.2% out of the 25% we needed. And to be honest, it was just a mountain too far to climb, really, because they'd already got 58.2%. And out of the, if you exclude the irrevocables, then, from the actual what was voted at the AGM, then there were 17 million votes done of 16 million of which were against the motion. And unfortunately, 16 million only translated to the total of 18.2%. So that's it. It's now done and dusted. And I still hold, and if anybody else still holds, I'll just say thanks. It was what I would say. It's good that people are voting in terms of AGMs where, you know, that they think it's the right thing to do, simply because you show you're a business owner rather than just a shareholder, a passive shareholder, because we need more people, small shareholders, to actually do that and, express their views. So that's how I would say, you know, give yourself a pat on the back for being a business owner rather than just a passive shareholder.
Yeah, and I agree with all that. And we've got the technology to do all this electronically. We've had the technology for 30 years to automate shareholder votes and do them online. But there's just this dreadful inertia, isn't there, that means that most company managements can pretty much do as they please. And this is why you're seeing remuneration and all these bonus and option schemes getting more and more obscene, because you don't have enough shareholders voting to hold them back.
Just got a bit of feedback, Paul. We'll make you happy. We've got John Canadine and Anne Comboy, both of them saying picture is fine here, no problem. So it's only me and you, which is great.
Yeah. Excellent news.
We've both been hoping that it was all fine. Okay, yeah. There was a guy who was asking you about, I know we talked about it briefly. Yeah, Koniki, he's asking about Beaks. The price seems to be moving up again. Any latest thoughts on Beaks? I know it's one of your star stocks.
Well, it was last year, but it's been very weak this year. There was a really good contract win recently, and the market almost disregarded it. So there's clearly somebody or persons unknown selling Beaks. I think the problem possibly is that here we are. They won an exchange cloud, which is the biggest contract, with the Australian Stock Exchange. And it's a significant multi-year deal, as they called it. And it's the 11th largest stock market. And actually, it's markets like that that are more significant for Beaks than say, NASDAQ. Because I've said this before and I've been criticized on the bulletin boards, people telling me I didn't know what I was talking about. And then I was delighted that the CEO of Beaks actually confirmed it, what I was saying, in his next webcast. So he was basically saying that it's the kind of second tier and even third tier stock markets where there's a much larger need for connectivity, which is what Beaks provides. And he's really bullish about the potential for Mexico and Australia. But at the moment, I don't know why the stock market just isn't interested. So I'm just going to be patient with Beaks. I don't think there's anything wrong with the company itself. And although it hasn't been raising forecasts, that's the other thing. People are saying, well, it's all very well announcing a contract. But part of the reason for that is that they're switching some of the new contracts over to profit share arrangements. So rather than, you know, a fixed fee. So Beaks itself doesn't know what money it's going to earn from those contracts until it's up and running, you see. Yeah. So they don't put them in the forecast, is my understanding. So, but I'm certainly hoping for pleasant upside surprises on Beaks as these contracts build. Management are bullish. I think there was a very small director sale by the fan. Well, not small to you and I, but quite a decent chunk of money, but small relative to his overall position. I think it's an open secret that he's going through a messy divorce. So it could well be related to that. But it didn't make much of a difference to his overall holding. So, yeah, I mean, look, I'd like more information on Beaks, but so far, so good as far as I'm concerned. But the stock market isn't interested at the moment.
Yeah, it doesn't, for some reason, that whole transition to a sort of SaaS recurring revenue model, it just doesn't like. And I think actually it's wrong so many times because people, you know, you will hate me for saying this, Paul, is that I think there's too many people who just look at the numbers rather than look in the strength of the business. Because when it goes to SaaS or it goes to ARR and you get built in and it's a consumption model, it becomes far more sticky, far more predictable. And the multiple you eventually get on the business is much, much higher. And that's what he's doing. And I think the value of the business is actually inherently increasing. But the stock market just can't handle it. It needs numbers and comparatives. It likes putting it into a spreadsheet and say software firms trade at X times sales, and this one is now not growing as fast. And on that basis, it's not part of this 40% club, or it isn't. You know, it deserves a lower multiple.
Yeah.
And which means that if you have faith and you believe in the long term picture, you'll come out with a much stronger business and a much higher valuation.
Yeah, no, I don't hate you at all for saying that. I think that's a valid point, Paul. one of the other points that I think, who was it? I think it was somebody quite prominent who was talking about what's going wrong with the London market. And he said, it's just people are too short term. That you just, people are going in and out of things and don't have any patience. And I think that reinforces what you were just saying.
Yeah, particularly for software companies where you do have this sort of like 18-month, two-year type transition to move from a sort of like more one-off perpetual license to a full SaaS position. Another one on that, thing in terms of software and highly, you know, sort of like a good stuff, is Cerillion, which shares were down remarkably 14% today because the CEO sold, I think it was about 1 million shares at roughly around about
3.
Sort of a big chunk, and it spooked the markets. How do you read this one?
Negatively, actually. I mean, I like Cerillion a lot. I think it's a superb company, amazing long-term track record. Yeah, we can see it there. It's sort of 15 or 20 bagged or something about the last 4 years. Cloud-based billing software for telecoms company. So it was just in the right place at the right time with the right product, and it's winning bigger and bigger contracts. But to tie that in with the recurring revenue thing, unfortunately, the downside with Cerillion is that it's still heavily reliant on winning large licenses. The recurring revenues element of it is much lower than it is with a lot of other software companies. So, which we've always flagged, we like it very much, but it is inherently risky. And I think my main issue with this it hasn't happened yet. It was a secondary placing that they announced an intention for the CEO to sell. I think it was 1.33 million shares, roughly 1.35. But it said a minimum of 1.33. So I want to wait and see what the total amount sold is. But the big issue is the discount. It closed last night at £19 a share. Mm. And they've announced that this secondary placing will be at £15 a share. Well, I think that's nearly a 20% discount, which is way too high. Yeah. And that I take as quite a bearish point, actually. You know, because why is he having to offer such a substantial discount to shift these shares away? So yeah, I was very disappointed by that. So I've dropped it a notch from 5-star to 4-star on my rating system. Yeah, just because I think this is a, you know, it's not good. There's no way you can try. And you often find when directors bank a big chunk of their existing holdings, 6 months later or so, something bad happens. You know, although to be fair, in this case, I think he's got something like 8 or 9 million shares in total. So, you know, let's be fair. Same with Gordon at Big's Financial Cloud. He's done some big sales, but still retains a huge holding. So, you know, it's not as if Lewis, isn't it, at Cerulean, not like he's sort of bailing out completely. Nowhere near. He's top slicing effectively. But I think it could have been handled better.
Yeah. It's one of those things, isn't it, really? I think if you know, he's gone through a proper placing to see whether institutional money wants to get in. Let's be clear about it. You know, 9 million shares at 15 quid. Yeah. Just doing the math. That's 135 million quid for one guy who owns 30% of the shares. It's a big sort of wealth concentration. I don't know how big his house is, but 135 million on one stock, even I would sort of sweat on that sort of stuff. And so he's only taken out just like, what, 16, 17 million quid. To be honest, I would say he deserves it. Give the guy a break, because
I think it wasn't for the £4 discount, though, Paul. I would say if he placed them at £18.50, I would agree. I would take the same view as you. It's the fact that he placed them at 15 quid. Such a big discount. That's the thing that's unsettled me.
Yeah, but even if you're a small cap shareholder, you know, 15, 16 million quid just to put, you know, to pick up. As in, like, you know, it's not small change, even for a lot of funds. I mean, a lot of funds are only 50, small caps are 50, 60 million, you know, sort of funds. And so do they have 16 million quid lying around for just something they weren't expecting but wanted to get in a high-quality company? And the answer to that is probably not. And therefore, I'm sure he didn't want to take the discount, but he was just forced into it to get that away. I don't know. Anyway, well, that'd be
my worry. That's the worry. Particularly if we get an update saying, oh, you know, this was to satisfy institutional demand. And you think, they've demanded a 20% discount, so the demand couldn't have been that enthusiastic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think the thing is, even at that lower price, they're still 9x sales. They're not exactly cheap. So I think, I would interpret it as a bit of top slicing, and, you know, the shares maybe have just got a bit ahead of themselves, nine times sales. So I wouldn't be surprised if something happens on something like, I don't know, Pinewood Technologies either, because I was looking.
Oh, I love that one. I really cross with myself for not buying those a while back.
Yeah.
Just going to give strength.
Yeah,
strength.
Give us your latest thoughts on Pinewood, because I think we both agreed it's a fab company. It's just not cheap. You've got to basically cross your fingers and pray that everything's going to go perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, the latest news from Pinewood is that it's restructuring the joint venture with Lithia, which really makes sense to me, because they said it created a quote competitor overhang. In the giving that we're trying to sell this software in the US, a bit very similar to when it was owned by Pendragon, actually.
Yeah.
Makes it difficult to sell to. So they restructured it so that Lithia is getting some shares in Pinewood, and I think will own more than 30%. So they've had a whitewash; so they don't have to bid for it. But it will then be Pinewood offering the software to all the other companies. So who maybe won't even check who's on the shareholder register at Pinewood. Why would they? So, and it said, this was 6th of June. It said positive current trading, highly confident in the future. Oh, and the other thing, of course, is that Lithia signed up for a $40 million per annum, 5-year contract, rising to $60 million per annum. So that in its, and I think they're still crunching the numbers because the brokers haven't put out revised guidance yet, but they're going to, I think, in due course. And it's going to be a big upgrade, isn't it? I would imagine. Yeah. So no, we're very, very keen on Pinewood, but unfortunately the share price has raced away too much for me to want to buy any personally.
No, same here. I mean, it's only on 10 times sales, which is why I think somebody will basically take some money out. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if Lithia starts selling some of the shares, actually. I know they're probably on a lock-it period, but at some point they'll want to take some of that out, I guess. But
yeah, I don't know. And I mean, at some point, you know, you've just got to let the share price settle or retrace a bit to let the fundamentals catch up, haven't you?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, if you're going to buy at the top of the mountain, everything's got to go right. And I like a bit of wiggle room. Something, if there's a couple of mistakes, it isn't quite as bad. Then there's a bit of sort of margin of safety. But sometimes you have to pay up for quality, no doubt about it. And that's been the case. They haven't put a foot wrong, Pinewood.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, I put all these sorts of things on a buy the dips list. You know, when there's the next Trump panic or China invades Taiwan, I don't know what, you know, there are all sorts of, or Israel bombs Iran. I mean, there's all sorts of macro risks around at all times. And I do think keeping a bit, I mean, I never do this myself. I wish I did. So I'm sort of preaching to myself here. I think keeping top slicing in the good times, having a bit of cash on the side, and then have a buy the dips list to pick up some bargains when everything sells off, when people panic, I think is a really good strategy. I just wish I could actually implement that strategy.
You're absolutely spot on. Now, that's exactly the thing that people should be doing. Okay, you've segued to a fabulous moment. Let's go to tech, with basically, which has sold off quite hard. It's got three stocks. Let's start with Bango, which is basically a payments business for largely Asia Pac, where they have mobile phones and most of them don't have bank accounts, and therefore they want to be able to shift money, and the telcos want to be able to get payments. And they've got this new digital vending service that allows the telcos then to bundle in numerous subscriptions onto their telco bill for their customers. And this is what they've just built. Now they're growing, they're getting lots of new customers and stuff. Shares have been sold off quite a lot over the last 5 years. And I think they're trading, when I last looked, actually, they're trading at around about 2x sales, even after today's uptick. What's sort of your latest on Bango?
Well, it's a share that I've in the past always kind of scratched my head over and said, oh, I don't really understand this, and moved on. But on, when was it? The 6th of June, I think that might have been last Friday, there was very little company news out. And I thought, well, I'll spend the morning looking into Bango properly. And I watched their webinar, which is, there's a recording on Investing in the Company. And it was quite late accounts for December 2024. And I asked them on the webinar, I said, I put in a question, three questions, which were all answered, even though they were quite tricky questions. So that makes me feel that management here are trustworthy. They've got an interesting little shareholder portal on their website where investors can lodge questions directly with them. I thought that was a nice touch. Anyway, it's reading between the lines. I think they had an issue over going concern, which is why the accounts were 2 months later than last year. And the CEO finessed it quite cleverly, but reading in answering my question. But it was, I think that's pretty clear what happened. But basically, there were concerns over cash flow and liquidity. Mm. But that's been sorted with a new, much larger bank facility, which the new CFO said he spent the first 2 or 3 months in the job sorting out. So I think that's really good, that a new CFO comes in, identifies that liquidity could be an issue and gets proper bank facilities in place. So he came across well on the webinar as well. And I should preface this by saying, I just thought I'm going to have a little bit of a punt on this. So I did buy a few, very badly timed at the high of the day. And then it started plummeting, of course. So I thought, oh, God almighty. But anyway, it bounced today back up to my buying price at 95p on news that a Korean telco has signed up for this digital vending machine, it's called, called. And it sounds very interesting. Just as you say, it's a payments company, basically, that it integrates. And I think it's all set up with APIs. So the customers only have to set up once on digital vending machine, and they can then adapt and put all sorts of different bundling offers through it, which apparently are the way that telcos are going at the moment, you know, offering premium packages where they can bolt on, say, I don't know, Netflix or various other services, and it all gets billed via Bango through to the customer's telephone bill. So I think it looks very interesting, actually, although some of my readers do point out that it's been promising great things for quite a few years and the growth seemed to have stalled. But they did explain they're just letting go of a lot of zero margin work. So again, I think that, as you were saying with SaaS, I think this is another situation where the revenue growth is masking strong underlying growth in the business they want, the higher margin stuff. So I think it looks to me like it's worth a punt. And it's only 67 million market cap or thereabouts. Yeah. So it is speculative. So it's not my usual value type play. And I don't know that much about it. This is probably the first time I've properly looked at it. So I only bought a few. So yeah, over to you, Paul. What's your take on it?
The key question for me is basically to ask what the competition's like in terms of the fintech sector out there. Because with the likes of Revolut, Wise, Monzo, you have bigger companies like that out in Asia and in South America, and they've basically stepped into the space that the banks haven't really been offering bank accounts, or there isn't many people who are banked, but the fintech guys have offered them apps that gave them banking on their mobile, and therefore you should be able to bundle in subscriptions. The difference, I think, with Bango is that it basically allows you, presumably, to play all those subscriptions. Let's just say you've got Netflix, Amazon, you know, basically Apple on there, and lots of other sort of really nice subscriptions. You've got the seamless way of one app, be it a super app, being able to do everything, and then it gets all billed to your telephone, you know, line, which is simpler and cleaner. But I would look if you could ever ask somebody to test out what the difference is between the really fast moving fintech boys out there, what they do compared to these, because I've got a sneaky suspicion what happens in payments is that you've got to offer everything. You've got to have basically, you've got to assume people might have a bank account. You've got to assume there could be a fintech, and then obviously they might want to put it on their telephone bill rather than just effectively nailing your flag to one mast, which is just billing on your telephone, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the there's another UK listed much larger competitor called Boku. So I had a look at their numbers, and that looks, you know, a decent business, profitable, cash generative, and so on. They were asked about the competitive threats on the webinar, and they did immediately say Boku. But as you say, there must be any number of other companies internationally that offer a similar type of service. Don't know on that front. But I don't think there's really a comparison with the Revoluts or the Wise type thing. This is kind of separate, just telecoms based, I think.
Yeah, but the point is that these guys will offer you a bank account, and you can bill all your subscriptions, your digital vending on a fintech app. You just can't play it out. That's the difference. Anyway, let's move to another tech company that's been fallen on tougher side. Let's go to GB Group, which is the ID low, you know, sort of theft fraud identification company. Plus, it also does location identification as well. Came out with an inline trading update, but the growth wasn't exactly as hot as I was expecting. I think it was like for like around about 3% or something. And then going forward, they're putting some more investment into their GB Go sort of fraud detection service. Shares have been sold off, though. I mean, I think the market were sort of took it as ho hub, and it trades now at less than 13 times PE for a previous darling, actually.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were really surprised at this dropping on the results. This was on 10th of June. My colleague Dave wrote up a section on this. We've had concerns about the balance sheet because it took on far too much debt to do a flurry of acquisitions, and it wasn't clear really if those acquisitions have added any value. But we were pleased to see that the balance sheet, while still technically quite weak, that has been the business has been very cash generative and has paid down. It's paying down the debt quite rapidly now, and it's only 49 million quid now, the net debt, which we're fine with the balance sheet now. And I think the fact that it's GB Group has successfully and dramatically improved its own balance sheet from its own internal cash flows tells you what a good business this is. Mm. So we think, I mean, like as you say, this is a former stock market darling on a humongous rating a few years ago, and it's now basically priced like a value share. We were very surprised it's come this far down. I mean, EPS, adjusted EPS, was up 15% for March 2025 year end, which is not too shabby, is it, really? Mm. So it's announced it's going to move from AIM to the main market as well, GB Group has, which could be causing some volatility. Maybe some of the inheritance tax portfolio guys will become forced sellers. I don't know. To me, there's not any clear evidence yet whether moving from AIM to the main market does add value. I think the jury's out on that at the moment. But no, I was very tempted to buy some, actually. I didn't buy any GB Group. But I think if it dips further, I'd probably get me wallet out and pick up a few.
So, back up the truck.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'd back up the truck. But I mean, because I don't really know anything about the competition or the business itself, really. So I just buy on the numbers, really, and a broad idea of what the business model is. But you've previously been quite bullish on this, Paul.
Yeah, I owned it back last year. I think I bought it roughly around about here, sort of like your 220, and then sold it out about £3, I think, just over £3. And I think it's a good, solid business, no doubt about it, with good repeat and recurring revenue streams. What sort of slightly the investment thesis that I'd predicated on was that once you actually go through sort of like the crypto problem of 18 months ago, then I thought they'd get back to like for like growth of high single digits or low double digits, like for like. And I've got a sneak suspicion I don't think they're going to do that. And the reason why I think my original thesis was wrong, I think there's greater competition in this, which is they're getting more volume, but the pricing's going down. They're seeing declines in pricing across its patch. And I think what that means is there's more people who are very technically good at this. And it's actually having declining prices. And I'm not, when you come to sort of software, what I love about software is it's sticky, it's recurring, and you have pricing power. And this is recurring, sticky, but doesn't seem to have pricing power.
Okay. I mean, it still makes very good margins, though,
which
suggests it has some pricing power. Interesting. I think it's just getting to a point where the valuation's not far off being quite compelling, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example. We've got Temperance Mysteries asking for thoughts on recovery of IOMart. And I own IOMart. And this is what I say. That it was a previous darling. It basically does data centers and it does a wrap of sort of cybersecurity and AI software services on top, largely through Microsoft software packages. And it's now starting to improve. But the reason I got it wrong was that I thought it was sticky, recurring, and had a pricing power. And it had the first two, but not the latter. And that's why I'm worried, a bit concerned about GB Group as well, whether there's other people. But anyway, I'll put my thoughts on IOMart are that I'm not adding to any, but I haven't sold any. What's your view on IOMart, Paul?
I haven't looked at it since February, when I think I remember talking to you about it at the time when we disagreed on it. It was a profit warning on the 7th of February. I didn't like it because the balance sheet was negative, too much debt after big acquisitions, low PE and good yield, though. But the weak balance sheet and the declining profits meant that I didn't want to get involved there. But it was 46p at the time. I don't know. Do you know what it is now, Paul?
29.
Is it? Oh, dear.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, Yeah, I mean, I think the key is they've bought this company called ATEC, which they've bolted onto their data centers business, which makes perfect sense. They can get higher margins, and ATEC is in all this Microsoft stuff and in cyber and AI, and their theory makes sense. They just overpaid, no doubt about it, for the transaction. Oh. Whatever they say, they overpaid. and they're saddled now, as you rightly point out, with a lot of debt. About, I think it's about 2.5, nearly 3 times, you know, EBITDA, and they haven't got any wiggle room whatsoever. However, somebody could come along and buy it at any day because they can do something more profitable with the infrastructure than the management team. But I basically, hands up, I got the investment thesis wrong. I was buying it about, I bought it about just over a quid, thinking that data centers, AI are going to do well. And frankly, I hadn't fully appreciated. They just didn't have the pricing power to be able to properly execute on that strategy.
Right. Do you ever use formal or informal stop losses, Paul? If you're starting to get cold feet about the investment thesis, is there a pain level of pain in percentage on paper losses where you can't, where you just decide to bail? I mean, what's your strategy?
No, I never use stop losses at all. I've always basically adopted the strategy that I want to make a decision about when I sell, and if the thesis is broken, I don't want somebody else to sell their shares, and it'll trigger my sale. There's no chance, and frankly, it doesn't work anyway, because I've got quite I invest in small cap companies. And as you know, I take quite big positions compared to most of the retail. Let's just say 2 or 3 retail go out that on a liquid stock that moves it by 20%. And then I've got like 10 times, 20 times what they've sold. It just isn't going to work, is it?
I was not necessarily thinking about automatic stop losses, but maybe a stop loss that you control. Do you look to something and say, if it's more than 30% underwater, you would think about selling? Or do you have anything like that?
No, it's all me. What about you, Paul? Are you sort of ever thought about using stop losses?
No, same thing. I don't want anything automatic, because I've used them a lot in the past, and you just find that some rogue fat fingered print or somebody deliberately manipulating the price will trigger your stop loss, and that's it. You've sold right at the low. But I do think a lot of my readers have persuaded me over the years that actually having some sort of informal process. So I'll give you a recent example was what's it called? The Insurtech.
Ondo Insurtech, Insurtech. Yeah.
With that one, I bought on a flurry of general investor interest, and I thought, I'll just dip my toe in with a small purchase. And it just kept dropping for on no news. And when it got to about 40% underwater, I just thought, do you know what? I'm done with this now. So on that occasion, and I think it's continued falling since, I think it's maybe not a bad discipline to have it at the very least a review with a fresh sheet of paper process. If something's dropped more than 30%.
I mean, I think you and I watch our shares and monitor our shares like the religion, don't we? I mean, let's be clear about it. You and I are so into the stock market. We don't need an alert to tell us a stock's going down, because we know it basically, and what the weaknesses and the RSI and all that kind of stuff. So we're all over it anyway. If you've got a stock that you're not massively certain about, your investment thesis is not that strong because you don't know about the industry and you haven't spoken to the management team, then maybe stop losses are not a bad idea. I personally think they just don't work for small caps. I would say if you're ever going to go stop losses, yes, they might work for large caps.
Yes.
Because then you get the liquidity. But for small caps, you're asking for a kicking. You'll sell at the bottom and buy at the top.
And often you're selling against yourself. That's the other thing, isn't it? If you try and gradually reduce a position and there's nobody buying, you just kill the price against yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The great question anyway, Paul. We've got another great question from Mike. He's asking you and myself, we've got something we want to find out about a particular company, we're doing some research and we don't get a response from that company or from their IR team. How do you interpret that?
I don't personally read a lot into it. I think the trouble is, in my experience, companies that are super keen to talk to investors and all the rest of it and turn up for the investor shows and things, there's usually a reason for it. It's probably because they've got an institutional seller that they need to keep create some liquidity for, you know. So I think, and whereas some of the best companies that I've encountered in my career have been owner-managed companies where they don't want to talk to anybody. Mm. You know, and people say, oh, I'm not going to invest in this or that company because there's no broker research. Management never return my calls. They don't show up for any of the shows or do webinars. I would counter that with by saying, well, they're usually the best performing company. A lot of them can be the best performing companies over the long term. So yes. Personally, I look through any sort of judgments like this. I mean, if somebody can prove statistically that actually companies that are really good on respond to you quickly and everything, if you can prove that there's a correlation between that and the long-term share price, great, you know, I'll do more of it. I talk to management a lot less than I used to because I think it clouds your judgment. Once you've sort of established a friendly rapport with the management team, it's very difficult to write rude things about them on my podcast, on my Substack.
You never do that.
I had a hilarious, I had drinks with one small company CEO a couple of years ago. And he was telling me, talking to me very openly about the business model and everything. Didn't tell me anything inside, obviously, because then you can't trade the shares, so you don't want that.
Yeah.
And he said to me, "Oh, and we've had a bit of a continual problem with price erosion." He said, "As you constantly remind your readers every time you write about us." It was luckily we had a good laugh about it.
Yeah. No, I mean, from my personal experience, I'm with you, Paul. There isn't one hard and fast rule you can actually adopt. Sometimes I've had it such that when a company goes quiet, then they've got a profit warning coming out, and you know, you have to make it just that's just the way it is. Then they can't talk to you. Another time, I've had it, you know, they've suddenly been acquired, you know, about 2 or 3 weeks later, so they couldn't have spoken to you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't read too much into it. Perfectly honest, it can be negative and it can be positive to a certain extent. But it's a great question, Mike. Anyway.
It is. Yeah. One of my friends who used to deal in more speculative microcaps, he said he's completely stopped talking to management of all companies because he's basically they're all lying. What's it?
They're not.
I know they're not, but mind you, he was doing junior resource stocks. So they probably.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. No, I wouldn't, yeah.
And he said basically if they won't put it in an RNS, but they'll kind of tell you something positive over the phone, you know, they're buttering you up. You know, if it was true, they'd put it in the RNS, wouldn't they? Yeah. So, I'm not a big fan of getting pally with management. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It worked for me many a time, but it doesn't always. It can. It's difficult to know to a certain extent. I mean, I find, to be perfectly honest, where I'm close to a company, then you get a sense of tone, how the business is progressing. And some of my biggest winners have been ones I've been close to the management team. And, you know, as I say, you got Crestchick, you got Equals, you got Alico, all of those, and OG, and all my four biggest, I was very close to the management team. The problem was I was also pretty close to the one Argentex, so it doesn't always work.
I agree with you. There's just no hard and fast rule on that. Every company is different. But I like to keep a certain distance, which is why I really like webinars, because you can get a feel for the type of people they are, and you can read it between the lines of what they're saying. You can see how much are they PRing or finessing things. So I can think you can get a lot of the good stuff out from a webinar, but without getting sort of pally with them and then feeling that it's difficult. It's difficult to sell if you've become essentially friendly with the management. Whereas if you keep that distance, you can just press the button. Something's not right, I'm out. Yeah. So, yeah. But everyone's got their own way of doing it, haven't they?
No, it is, yeah. No, I'd agree. Not there's no one rule fits all, that's for sure. Okay, let's move to the last one on the tech, which has been bombed out, that potentially is a turnaround. But let's go to Cerebras Technologies. Basically does sort of like software that allows advertisers and retailers online to identify fraud for sort of like, you know, from individuals, and also to personalize marketing campaigns to individuals as well. Largely sells through the channel out into the States. Had a tough time actually over the last few months, largely because of deferred orders. Plus it's changing its accounting policies to more SaaS rather than upfront licensing, and I think you had one of its channel partners has decided to stop reselling some of its third-party software as well. So it's all come to a head. The shares are now pretty much bombed out. Looking at it, they trade at 1.4 times sales, but the balance sheet is rock solid.
Yes. Sorry, your sound just dipped out there, Paul.
Oh, sorry, Paul. Yes. So basically, the balance sheet is rock solid as well. Is this a value trap or a value play with Celebrus? Because it is software and it has done well in the past. It's just that the moment it's gone through a problem time. Is it something to buy the dip, or is it better to wait until they put their next results out, which will sort of like give guidance about their forward path?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I almost bought some of these yesterday, actually, funnily enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't looked at the agenda for today, so I didn't know this was coming up. But, yeah. I mean, obviously, the shares are doing the opposite of what everything else is doing, which makes you ask the question, why, doesn't it? You know, we've had an utterly roaring bull run in the last month or 6 weeks now, and this has carried on going down. So you've got to ask the question why. But it is getting to very interesting value for sure. As you say, I mean, the market cap now is only 62 million. And when it last reported for the March 2025 trading update, it had $31 million in net cash. So even allowing for the US dollar depreciation, that's well over £20 million, isn't it? That's over a third of the market cap is now net cash. Mm. And it is genuine net cash. It's not just customers paying up front. It's got a bulletproof balance sheet. It's looking very tempting, but we would effectively just be punting on it because we don't know what current trading is like. The update on the 22nd of April was the outlook sounded quite uncertain. And also Cavendish and Canaccord both withdrew forecasts. Yes. Now that is, in my experience, never good news.
No,
you know, it did say though, profit before tax would be slightly ahead of expectations for March 2025. And as you say, there have been some accounting policy changes. So unfortunately, I can't really shed any light on this one, Paul, other than that I think it does look very tempting for sure. But you can't, it's so difficult to buy when you're effectively now in an information blackout period. You know, I'd rather buy on the opening bell when the March 25 figures come out and maybe pay 10% more than the current price to have the certainty that I'm not just about to walk into a profit warning.
You and I are totally aligned on that one, Paul, because I've been watching it for some time. I like it. It's good technology. It's part channel partners work. Celebrus is actually thought of as very good software in that sort of industry and stuff. It's got some excellent customers. However, it is a massive leap of faith to basically, when you're changing your accounting, when you've just lost a customer, the reselling, and you've also you know, basically seeing softer decision slower decision making by your customers.
Yeah.
Add all those together, it's a massive leap of faith to basically say, okay, right, I'm going to put the flag to the mast and buy big, because I think you're setting yourself up for a hiding, because they will reset the profit here, and it just depends on how far the down it is, which is what the lack of guidance, the withdrawal of guidance from the brokers is saying. They're saying we don't know it, but we know it's going to be not great, and therefore we don't want to prematurely downgrade and then downgrade again. It doesn't make any sense.
Yes, that's right. But at some point, things just get so ridiculously cheap that you just think, sod it, I'm just going to take the risk, don't you? And I would say with Celebrus, it's not far off that level, in my opinion. And if you're buying something with an utterly bulletproof balance sheet and a massive surplus cash pile, you've got that protection, haven't you? You know, you're not going to have to worry about dilution from an emergency fundraise. So you could argue it either way, couldn't you? I think if I was flush with money, I'd probably have a little punt on it.
I'll tell you and I get our investment thesis, our investment outlook, and what we now we're getting even closer and closer.
Because it's similar, isn't it?
It is, very similar indeed. Okay, we got Drew. He's asking about retailer The Works, which basically does I think it's sort of like a low value everyday items in a sort of like in a shop format on old UK high streets. Shares have done really well. It's been direct to purchases, Drew is saying as well. Shares have gone from 20p to, in fact, they've more than doubled. But we did see that today, Poundland going bust into resolvency. That may be good for it, actually. I don't know. What's your view anyway in the round?
It's done a lot better than expected, actually. There was a good announcement on, a very good announcement on the 22nd of May, trading update. This was for April year end. And the shares went up 22% on the day and carried on rising. I think there have been some traders getting involved in this, saying that, and certainly one of my team, John, he looked at it and said that, yes, this the turnaround is progressing. But one of the things we flagged was that with the April year end, it only would have had 1 month of the higher wage costs and the higher NIC. And they do tell us that it's going to be, I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but it was a huge figure headwind for the new financial year. But they're still upgrading the forecast guidance for this year, which I think is just too tall an order. You know, it's multiple millions, the headwind from, because staffing will be their biggest cost. I don't want to get involved in any kind of marginal retailers. And I would say, I mean, I'm surprised the Works is still in business. You know, I thought it would have been one of the, as you say, I think Poundland have been numerous marginal retailers who've just gone bust. And I mean, fair dues to them. The Works has survived and actually posting half decent numbers, but very, very small profit margin. I don't believe the April 26 forecasts personally because of the wages headwinds. So it's just not something that I'm personally going to get involved with. But, you know, well done to people who've doubled their money on it. Good trade.
Yeah, no, yeah, I would agree. You're right. I mean, it definitely isn't the kind of thing I would be buying, but it just shows, isn't it? Any stock, I mean, to double your money in about a month, it's, I'll take that any day of the week.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we got Lemon Physical. He's asking about System One, I think, Sisys One. He's a marketing company and stuff. The shares, I think, have been sold off a bit. But don't you any quick thoughts? About 52 million or so?
Yeah, we like this one. This is another one that, a bit like Celebrus, is on my... my hand just caught the microphone. It's on my... buy the dips. I'd like to own this one, actually. I think it looks very interesting. It dropped on the 23rd of April. That was the most recent news, unless I've missed anything.
Yeah.
On a trading update, dropped 13%. The fizz seems to have really gone out of this share. It maybe did get a bit overvalued. It's got a decent balance sheet with plenty of net cash. About a quarter of the market cap is net cash. It was £4.65 when we last looked at it. Have you got a price on this one now?
Yeah, Paul? It's £4.07 now.
Oh, it's come down a bit more. I think it's interesting. They do some sort of specialist marketing services on the effectiveness of adverts, I think.
Yeah.
And they do, I think we've talked about this one before. They do seem to have something that the clients want and need. And I think it's a very interesting company. I'd like to learn more about this one. Not quite cheap enough for me to want to buy as yet. But again, it would be a buy that if it keeps falling, I'd probably start dipping my toe in. So it sounds like you know it reasonably well, Paul.
No, I don't know it massively, but I actually think marketing technology, MarTech, is actually really competitive, and it's so difficult to understand how much money, you know, the likes of Google and Facebook and Amazon and all these guys are pumping into it, and what the technology is. And it's a difficult one for competition on software. And then the other thing I would say more broadly is that this type of software, plus the stuff that, the AI boys are doing in terms of, you know, being able to do generative adverts and this sort of stuff, is going to kill the main advertising agencies, the likes of WPP. I think they're going to really struggle because of this whole move in technology with MarTech. And I hate to say it, and I know I put it on your Substack last week, and I got a bit of pushback, but I'm turning off the big online publishers, the likes of Future and LB, you know, Lads Media, LBG Media, Trustpilot, and all these other ones that rely on click-throughs from, you know, basically the blue links for Google. I think everyone on those models is going to really struggle for the next few years because they've been relying on volume and traffic to make them get adverts, and I think that's going away quick, actually.
That was an interesting debate, actually. You just reminded me. I followed what you'd written on my Substack, and then you got some reader replies. I think one guy who's pretty smart, he said that he didn't think Future relied on blue click links. Which, so I don't know on that one. I haven't really got anything to add to the debate, but I'm very tempted to buy Future. That is also on my possible buys list. It's so cheap now. And but I think somebody was saying the companies that have got the original content that's behind paywalls are actually going to be more valuable because AI can't just scrape that content from behind a paywall. Although actually it was quite interesting. One of my team did a ChatGPT search and somehow it's managing to partially at least get behind my paywall. So I put my content behind a paywall on Substack, and ChatGPT seemed to somehow at least get the gist of it and only wrote like one sentence, but saying what color code we'd been. And we were thinking, how the hell has it done that? It shouldn't be able to access paywall content. Do you know anything about that, Paul?
No, I don't think it can, unless it's got a license. There's quite a few, they do buy paywall content. So for the Financial Times, has got to deal with, I think it's ChatGPT, and I've got a sneak suspicion Google has got one. Alphabet's got one with the Wall Street Journal as well, so they get proprietary access to it. But frankly, let's be clear about it: paywalled content, other than yours, is not always that great a lot of the time. You know, Financial Times, yes, I subscribe to it. Wall Street Journal, yes, I've subscribed to it. But frankly, I could get a better reply from AI generative just by looking at what's happening around the world and getting it from other sources a fuller response. So. I think what you're talking about is proprietary, really valuable data, medical data, really niche stuff that you do and with insights and stuff like that. But if you're selling a paywalled data service that's not a killer, then I think you're going to struggle, to be perfectly honest. I really do, go.
Yeah, I agree. And it's. I mean, I found even with my Substack, you know, it's original content, lots of it. It's a team of four guys who are all very experienced. And even then, getting people to part with £100 a year is difficult. And you think, it's crazy. Most of these people have got six or seven figure portfolios, but they don't want to pay £10 a month to get original content. Right. Mind you, enough people do, so I'm not... But I think there are, but as some of the readers have said, the trouble is we've got a subscription for this, a subscription for that, and it can mount up, you know, into a lot of money. But I was at the Substack bestsellers party, summer party this week, which was great. I'm talking to lots of journalists and one of the three founders of Substack itself, I had a chat to, and basically they were saying the same thing. Actually getting people to cough up for content is very difficult. It's got to be unique, it's got to be something that you can't just get elsewhere, hasn't it? But it's very interesting how all this is developing.
I pay for a lot of content in terms of, you know, the main journals and this sort of stuff. But I definitely want to pay for yours because I genuinely think it's fabulous. It really is. You don't get it anywhere else. You bring it to life, and I listen to it every single day, and it means that I haven't got to read all the RNSs. So it's a win-win-win. You win, I win, and it helps my investment. So I would recommend it to anybody, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, that's very kind. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.
Well, anyway, let's finish on one final. David Raywood is asking about... just this spurge we've had in acquisitions and M&A this week, and particularly any quick thoughts on Ricardo being taken out, because I think it was a bit of a bumper payday for one of its largest shareholders, Science Group.
Oh, I know. Wasn't that a marvellous outcome for Science Group? I did cheekily email the CEO there and said, come on, do a podcast with me. You've done brilliantly on this deal, you know. But he said, politely declined. He just likes being very private, I think. It's a fantastic outcome. And I mean, I think Science Group really is a cracking company. And I mean, the fact they've pulled off, I think it was something like 20 million profit they've made, I think. Yeah. By buying that stake in Ricardo, and it used up the lion's share of of science groups is cash reserves. Yeah. So this was a really ballsy move he took. We bought 22% of Ricardo, and then look at around £2, and look at the result. So yeah. I'm just full of admiration for Science Group in pulling that off, and I wish I'd followed them on the trade. I think we might have even discussed it at the time, saying,
yeah,
should we just jump on the back of the coattails of this, because something might happen. I don't know, I talked myself out of it. So no, absolutely thrilled for the Ricardo shareholders, they've all done well, and thrilled for Science Group and their shareholders, who've done, I think, pulled off a terrific coup here. So well done all round, I would say.
Yeah, and I would just add, look at the other acquisitions as well. We've had Spectris being taken out, and think about other companies that potentially fit that same mark with high performance sort of instrumentation. I would, have a look at things like Oxford Instruments, Renishaw, another one which is a perennial takeover target. And I think a lot of these real sort of like high quality crown jewels on the UK market are going to get lifted and shifted at some point in time. And stick them on your watch list and do what Paul says, basically buy on the dip, because it's a proven strategy.
Yeah, and I think buying a basket of things as well. I mean, the REITs are all coming back into focus. We've had several deals in the last week or two on REITs as well. Mm. I think Assura, is that the GP surgery one? I think
GPs,
the bidder raised the price again. You've had another one, PHS, I think it is, the build to rent thing has been in play for a while, and some of them are paying up nearly NAV. Others, you look at them and you think, God, that's a 15-20% discount to NAV. So I'm going to try and find the time to look through all the REITs again. I think there's some lovely opportunities there, and the infrastructure funds, and you're getting paid big dividends of these things. A lot of them are bounced a lot, but it only takes one RNS of the company to say, we're now doing a strategic review to look at unlocking the discount to NAV, and you'll make about 20% just on that one RNS. So loads and loads of opportunities. I find it very difficult to predict which companies are going to be takeover targets, though. I have to say, it often just comes out the blue and you think, why are they doing that? And it's because they're working out the synergies, or they've worked out they can raise the company's selling price. There's all sorts of reasons why bids happen that I find very difficult to predict. I'm not good at identifying which companies are likely to be bid for. So if you're better than me at it, Paul, tell us what we should be buying.
No, I mean, I think the principle that we both adopt is that you buy something with a margin of safety, i.e. you buy on the dip good quality companies. And also, if it's a potential takeout target and that's not in the price, then you get that as a free optionality that when it happens, then then you'll be absolutely delighted. So that's how I think both you and I did it. By the way, Paul, I've got Lauren Scott Harp says, happy birthday. It wasn't your birthday, is it?
Oh, it is, yes.
Oh, congratulations. Fantastic. She's drawn a nice big cake with three candles on, which I think is, 93, is it?
Oh, she's forgotten the other 54. I have actually, as it's my birthday, I've celebrated with one can of Carling.
Oh, see, oh, congrats, fantastic.
While we've been talking, so that's why I've been getting increasingly jolly.
Okay, yeah. So you were born in 68, were you?
Yes, yes. So the next thing you'll be asking me what my mother's maiden name is. We're giving away too much information here, Paul.
Yeah, well, I hope you have a good evening tonight. Then you certainly deserve it, mate.
Thank you. And I'm off into Soho with some friends to have a meal with some American friends who are visiting. So,
fantastic. Yeah,
tomorrow's report will hopefully still be on time.
Well, it's always a quiet day on Fridays.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for your questions. Apologies if I haven't got through to all of them. Hold them and then please put them into the chat bot next week or any others. We're bound to have lots and lots of new ideas to talk about. And again, as always, Paul, thanks very much for your comments and insights on today's show. Excellent as always. So thanks again.
Thanks for hosting it, Paul. And bye, everyone.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use. Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.